So we do have quite a few that are joining us for the first time. I want to just kind of retouch on a couple of things. But the most important thing for me was this book, God's Word. And for me to have to come to the grips that there were just some things that myself, my friends, my scientific friends, there were just some things that we do not know, and we will never know until we come face to face with the creator of the universe. That's a real big pill for a scientist to swallow. Because if my students would ask me a question and I couldn't answer it, I'd try to baffle them with terminology, and if that didn't work, I'd try to humiliate them into silence. But I always would come up with the idea that, well, we may not know it now, but we will. And that was kind of what Charles Darwin did. I don't know if any of you have actually read his book, Origin of the Species, by Means of Natural Selection. He even said that his theory was pretty weak because the fossil record was so incomplete, but further years down the road, we would find that missing link. But if we didn't, then his whole theory was worthless. Well, guess what? Yeah, his whole theory is nonsense. But we need to put our own word. You need to put your own nose in this word. Ask the person who wrote the book. You know, I said last night, you know, you won't get to heaven on your mother's religion. Well, you won't get there on my science either. It's a relationship between you and the Holy Spirit. And I'll tell you, that was a hard lesson for me. I didn't accept Christ until I was 1 month after my 40th birthday. And I came kicking and screaming. But you see, I thought I was a Christian. As I told you last night, I grew up in a Christian home, and I just assumed, since my mother was a Christian and I was born in America and we prayed before meals and we went to church, that I was a Christian. I didn't know about the relationship with Jesus. So when I got into high school and I was so enamored with science, I was a science nerd from the get-go, my first period teacher was the biology teacher. Like I said last night, I took science first period. Most of my friends took study hall. But the science teacher was also the freshman football coach. And to me, great athlete, great scholar, hello God, there he was. And when he told me that religion was a myth and that science had proven that the earth was millions of years old and that we evolved from this warm little pond of slime into where we are today, I was devastated. I thought, well, did my mother or my grandmother lie to me? What was that all about? So I set out at age 14 to prove that science had the answers. That's why I have all these degrees. I couldn't decide which ology I liked best. I tried all the different ologies. But you know what ology means? Ology just means the study of. It's when we add the prefix biology, study of life, geology, study of the earth. Ologies are great. But there's something that makes our ologies work, and it's called math. Math is so amazing, and it's so frustrating to the scientific community because nobody can claim they invented it. They just discovered it. It was there. Everything is mathematical. I mean, the universe, the computers, look at the math and the laws of probability. And we can do math today that the great scientists of the past, like Einstein and Max Planck and Bohr and all these guys, they couldn't even imagine the calculations that a fifth grader can do. Well, I want to take you on a little journey tonight. As I said, I didn't accept Christ 1 month after my 40th birthday. And I came kicking and screaming because I was so convinced. What I had, folks, was great faith in my religion, which was science. I worshiped at the altar of science. And that's what we're talking about. We're talking about two faith-based religions. You know, I get really irritated when I hear people say, well, you can't, you, you Christians, you're not scientists, that's metaphysics, and you can't teach creation in the classroom because that's not empirical. We can only teach science. Guys, we need to stop that. Let's just call them what they are. They're both religions based on faith. And I'm going to show you that. We're going to get into the math and so forth. So the problem was, I did not want to believe in God. That was the bottom line. Because the way I was living, my lifestyle, I did not want to be accountable to God. You know, I didn't want to share the glory with God. You know, I'm a sinner, and I can prove it. Mm-hmm. So to be accountable to the creator of the universe was, I just didn't want that. So I ended up choosing to believe in science in spite of the evidence, not because of it. And as I said last night, it's okay to have different opinions. That's legal. No problem. But it's not okay for us as teachers and scientists to inflict our opinion on our students as fact. And that's what's happening. Students are being taught what to think, not how to think. Discouraged from questioning. That's why I titled this Science and it's not Science versus the Bible. Who created science, folks? God. It's science and the Bible. What you're not being told fills volumes. That's the sad part. But see, as I said, I was a late bloomer. I taught high school for years, and then after I got my graduate degrees, I ended up teaching at the university. And I actually gave lower grades to some of my students because they irritated me. They were Christians. They wouldn't believe me. And see, I felt it was my duty as a scientist, as a teacher, to protect those poor, ignorant Christians from that myth. And that's exactly what I felt. If some of my Christian students, I would just pat them on the head. Oh, you poor little ignorant Christian, go back to your desk. You know, how much of that can you take? You see, but what I didn't realize is that I was the one that was deceived. I was the one that was lost. So what I didn't realize, I didn't sit out with premeditated desire to deceive my students. I just passed on my deception. I was deceived, so I just passed it on. So when I did accept Christ in 1987, I only lasted about 6 months. I ended up at a church where I raised my right hand and swore I would never set foot. In fact, I used to go down, I grew up in Newport Beach, and we'd go down and throw water balloons at the baptisms down there in Corona Del Mar. And I was throwing at the Jesus freaks, and I kept trying to hit the ball guy that was baptizing everybody, Pastor Chuck Smith. See, I know God has a sense of humor because he married my wife and I. He baptized me in that same cove, and I worked for him for 3 years. Okay, God, you're getting my attention. But the sad part was I ended up in that church in Calvary Chapel in Costa Mesa. And I remember, I'd get there hour early just so I could get my seat. And my sister bought me a really cool brand new King James Bible with a leather cover with a dove on it. Boy, I carried it everywhere. It sat beside me in my truck. I just never opened it. That's the problem. You have to go personally. You have to develop that relationship with Jesus yourself, not by what I say. But I remember one Sunday morning, I got up. I think Chuck was preaching on the unpardonable sin, and that just did me. I knew I was done because I'd done all the rest of them, so I must have done that one. So I got up out of the chair, got in my car, and drove from Newport Beach to Big Bear, California, got out of the car and threw that fancy Bible my sister gave me and off into the snow because I couldn't come to grips with Genesis. As a scientist, it was impossible. I kept trying to bring God down to my size, put him in the box. I actually became a theistic evolutionist. And folks, that is the most dangerous. It is far more insidious than just plain old Darwinism. Theistic evolution is when you say that God started that first cell. Do you ever hear, could God use evolution? Well, of course God could use evolution. He's God. But he says he didn't. And if you phrase it properly, it shouldn't be, could God use evolution? It should be, did God use evolution? Then we can go to his word, and we know Because he tells us, first of all, you humans are created in his image, not in the image of a protozoan. But 1 Corinthians 15:39, that one was the one that kind of helped seal the deal for me. Because if God used evolution, which means he started that first cell and let it evolve over millions of years from one flesh to another flesh, up to the chimps into the humans, then God is a liar, and that is something he cannot do. His character does not allow him to lie. 1 Corinthians 15:39 says, all flesh is not the same flesh, but there is one kind of flesh of men, another flesh of animals, another of fish, and another of birds. End of discussion. Could God use evolution? Yes. Did he? No. He says no. But we spend so much time as scientists trying to read between the lines and add to. God says, do not add to or take away from my word. He didn't write this book for PhDs. And as I said last night, my mom pointed out, PhD just stands for piled high and deep. But let me tell you. But see, I may have underestimated evolution. And I told you last night, my PhD says evolutionary biologist right on it. So that makes me a professional evolutionist. And I tell people, yep, I believe in evolution. I know it works because I have evolved into the creationist I am today. See, evolution itself is not a dirty word. It just means change. It's when we add micro and macro in front of it, we get into trouble. And let me tell you, there is no such thing as macroevolution. That means one species changes into another. Microevolution, no problem. We know that things adapt and change. But here's something that's not often pointed out in science. Science cannot prove or disprove historical scenarios. Science cannot go back in time and prove evolution. You can't go back and prove spontaneous generation, the Big Bang. Science can only deal with the here and now and the recent past. But God said that we, as his people, are destroyed for lack of knowledge. But how much knowledge can we take? Last night I showed you the numbers. Knowledge doubled the first from 1700 to 1850. It was 150 years, it doubled. Then it started to double every 50 years, then every 10 years, and today it's doubling at about every 12 months. So how much more can knowledge increase? But here's the sad thing. Many professors view their mission as helping poor right-wing Christian children outgrow their parents' faith. We are just trying to open their minds. That's what a college education is all about. Yes, we're Christians, but we have to challenge our incoming students' narrow fundamentalism in order to broaden their perspective and make them well-educated. Do you catch what that's saying? Guys, that is just wrong. And as I said, we're talking about two faith-based religions here, so we need to allow people to see all of the evidence, both sides of the story. If we're expecting our students and you as students to make decisions, but we're not giving you all the information, then that is just flat wrong. And here, as I said in Hosea, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. One of the things that really caused me grief, and things started to chip away. Like I said, it was not till I was 40 years old. A bunch of things started happening. Every time I looked into a microscope, as a biologist, I would have to turn and walk away because what I was looking at was so perfectly designed. I had to convince myself that what I was looking at wasn't designed. Don't you think I would get a hint? You know, since it screamed design, and we can't come anywhere near that perfection in design. You know, people have tried to create cells and life in a test tube. It has not worked, and it will never work. Life from non-life does not happen. If that were the case, every time you opened a can of tuna, you'd find a whole new life species. The complexity of the human genome is absolutely overwhelming. How many of you heard of the Human Genome Project? Several years ago, Dr. Francis Collins and a team of scientists mapped the entire human genome. As far as I'm concerned, that is the most incredible biological scientific event in my lifetime, to map the entire human genome. Well, here's there are several problems. Anytime you have competition, and we did, we had a team led by Dr. Francis Collins, and we had a couple of other teams that were competing, a couple of pharmaceutical companies, they were competing. Everybody was competing to be the first to map the genome, to get these copyrights and be first and get the Nobel Prize. And so anytime you have competition, you have shenanigans and you have room for messing around, cheating. Well, Dr. Collins' team won substantially. The other team were absolutely devastated when Dr. Collins presented his research. Their team got the Nobel Prize. But what they found was that the human genome was so much more complex than they had ever imagined, and that there were far more, and by the way, the genome, all that is, that means you're all of the genes that make you a human. Your entire genetic makeup is the genome. Well, one of the things that happened is when Dr. Collins presented his work, other scientists started finding, how come they were so fast and they got this done? Well, what they found when they started going back over the research, they found that Dr. Collins' team had arbitrarily just discarded 10,000 sequences of the genome. And when he was called on it, he said, well, that was just junk DNA. Well, guess what, folks? There is no such thing as junk DNA. It is all has a problem. In fact, what they found is that some genes in the DNA were multifaceted. They were coding for more than one thing at a time. And by the way, the human genome, you know, every gene in your body, the DNA has more information than the entire Library of Congress. But one of the things that the other thing they found with that map in the genome is that your entire genome was decaying. It was subject to the second law of thermodynamics. Hear that? Another law. Remember, the law of biogenesis is that life only comes from life. The law of thermodynamics is that everything is decaying. I mean, I know that. I look in the mirror every morning and see the genome decaying. But everything, including our universe, our sun, everything is decaying. But what they were astounded was the rate of the decay. Did you ever wonder when you're reading God's word and you read about people and Noah and prior to the flood, how they lived for hundreds of years? See, because when God created Adam and Eve, they were created perfect. There were no flaws, no mistakes, no decay in their genome. That didn't happen till the fall. And then prior to the flood, you could see how the lifespan started going down as the genome started to decay over time. Well, what the team that mapped the genome found is that the genome was decaying at a rate they were absolutely alarmed. They couldn't believe it. It was over 100 deleterious, that's detrimental, mutations per person, per generation. So in other words, I have 100 more detrimental mutations in my genome than my dad had. My son has 100 more than me and 200 more than granddad. Do you catch where I'm going now? Dr. John Sanford and a team of scientists, Dr. Sanford, has written a book. It's called Genetic Entropy. As college students, you should look that up. Dr. John Sanford, professor at Cornell University, along with 5 other geneticists. And guys, that's important. You know, my PhD is in evolutionary biology. And that's important. Remember when the Al Gore thing came out and said 2,500 of the world's leading scientists signed this thing that global warming is going to kill us all. Do you know that when they looked up those names on that, those 2,500 scientists, not one single climatologist signed it? They had PhDs in accounting and PhDs in technology and everything, but no climatologist signed it because they knew it was a farce. It was a hoax. So that's why it's important. Like, if you were diagnosed with a brain tumor, would you go to a brain surgeon or a podiatrist? You see, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure that out. So that's why it's important that Dr. Sanford and his team were all geneticists, and two of them had multiple PhDs. They wrote the book called Genetic Entropy, and what they pointed out was the mathematical probabilities and the possibilities with the rate of the decay. They actually, instead of using 100, which was, that's really in the ballpark, it might even be a little more, they decided to cut it in half. And then they mathematically, and by the way, it took the entire massive computer at Cornell University, they backed it up, figuring out how many mutations per year, per generation, all the way back to Adam and Eve. You know that no matter what they did, how they messed with it, they could not go back more than about 6,000 years or the entire human race would be extinct. Isn't that interesting? And in that book, he talks about the primary axiom. That's the primary axiom, by the way, is a fancy term for Darwinian evolution. That is that time plus natural selection plus mutation results in the diversity of life. Guys, that is nonsense. Mutations are 99% fatal. 99%. That leaves 1%. That 1% is benign. Do you know what that means? It doesn't do anything. 100% of the time, mutations do not result in new information. It is a loss of information. Do you catch that? So then how can you use mutation as a catalyst to form life? Let's give that first miracle, that life, that first cell spontaneously generated. Where did it get the information to duplicate itself? Or the information to become an eyeball or a more sophisticated organism? It's impossible. Mathematically, it is absolutely dead. So, and here's the one that I always use. Well, you know, given enough time, anything is possible. Boy, that is baloney. That is nonsense. Time is not the magic ingredient. Time does not add any new information. And natural selection can only select for what is there. You catch that? It can't select for something that's down the road. But see, nobody stops to look at that. The teachers don't even know that half the time. So, you see, we as Christians are making some inroads. But look at this. The other thing is information. What is information? Where does information come from? I talked last night, I told you about Dr. Werner Gitt. Werner Gitt is a professor at the German Federal Institute of Physics in Germany. He wrote a book a number of years ago called In the Beginning Was Information. That book was suppressed in the United States. They won't even review it. I think it's even out of print by now. But one thing that happened is Dr. Gitt in that book made a statement and a quote, and no scientist in the world will argue with it. And they can't. That's why they don't want you to read the book. His quote was, information does not originate by itself in matter. That's pretty clear. It doesn't spontaneously generate. The information in this computer didn't spontaneously generate in here, did it? I didn't buy this gray box and sit it here and all of a sudden it was full of information. Where did the information in my PowerPoint come from? The creator of the PowerPoint. Where did the information in the computer come from? The creator of the computer. So if information doesn't originate in matter, And the scientific community says that the universe contains 10 to the 90th bits of information. You see the problem? If the universe contains 10 to the 90th bits of information, and guys, that is a huge number, all you have to do is ask, where did that information come from? If it doesn't originate in matter, where did it come from? There's only one explanation. It had to come from the creator of the universe. Information requires one thing: intelligence. You see the problem? But that's not being taught. Look at this. Each individual human being has approximately 37.2 trillion cells in our body. You create a million cells per second as long as you were alive. Now, how does that compute spontaneous generation? No intelligence, no design, no creation. That is flat mind-numbing. Well, if we have 37.2 trillion cells, how about this? Each cell in our body has an astounding 100,000 chemical reactions per second occurring in over 37 trillion cells. Enzymes are indispensable to keep this amazing process humming. And that's supposed to have just occurred randomly with no design, no intelligence. Do you see the problem? But see, why is it important that we deal with Genesis? Because it's the foundation. It's the very first book. And I don't care what you build the building out of, space age technology, if your foundation is poor, the entire building will fall down on your head. Genesis is the foundation. Everything we do and are comes from Genesis. The word Genesis itself, look what, it means origin. And the book of Genesis gives the only true, reliable account of all the basic entities of the universe and life. No other book on the planet covers like Genesis. The following is just, that's just a short list of Genesis. Where did the origin of the universe come from? Genesis. Origin of order and complexity? Genesis. Origin of the soul? Genesis. Origin of life? Genesis. Origin of life? You catch the drift? Do you understand why it is so important that Genesis is true? And so I get really upset when people, especially Christians, they say, well, you can't take Genesis literally. Really? How else are you to take it? If you tell me that this is just poetic then don't get in my face with John 3:16, because who are you to tell me which parts are true and which aren't? It's either all true or none of it is true. That's my thick head talking. That's how I looked at it. So that's why I had to come to grips with Genesis. Like I said, I threw the Bible away because I couldn't make it work. I kept trying to bring God down to my size, put him in the box. But you know that God says there are just some last mysteries. There's some things that only he knows. Wow, that was a load lifted off my back. I realized I don't have to prove or disprove anything. It's not my job. I can't do it anyway. I don't have to prove it. But God says it's by faith that we'll know, not by evidence. But he didn't say blind faith. That's why we have so much evidence. And that's why that evidence is being suppressed, because the standard evolutionary program based on Darwinian uniformitarianism is bankrupt. It cannot stand up to comparison. That's why it is outlawed. Guess who owns the school system? The secular humanists. And as I said yesterday, I was not an atheist, folks, for those 40 years. That was way too passive for me. I was an anti-Christian. I hunted them down. So I had this massive guilt trip when I did accept Christ. But see, I did not want to believe in God. That's why my prayer this morning was, God, give me as much faith in your word as I had in man's word. Because, guys, that's all you have. You only have two choices. And if that's all you have and you don't want to believe in God, guess what you're going to do? You're going to hang on to what you have and suppress God. And guess, they own the system, so they're doing it. like I said, evolution will not stand up to comparison with the, that's why I showed you last night, I might show it again, those bags full of fossils, hundreds of thousands of fossils locked away in warehouses with a lead seal, with a yellow tag that says anomaly. And you know what anomaly means? Is it doesn't fit. So there's hundreds of thousands of fossils that go direct contradiction to Darwinian evolution are locked away. So I could stand up in front of my students and honestly say, well, according to the available evidence, see, I don't tell them about the evidence that's not available. You see what I mean about what you're not being told? I asked this question to 600 scientists down in Southern California at a science conference. I thought I would be clever and get a response, and boy, did I. I asked them how we date fossils. Well, I knew every hand would go up. I said, how many people in this room have an idea? You know it, you've heard it, somebody's told you, you read it, you have an idea how we date fossils. Well, every hand shot up. Well, how many of you have an idea? Yeah. Probably most of you have an idea. Well, when I asked that group full of scientists, you know what they yelled at me? Carbon 14. Guys, that was mind-numbing. I was not prepared for that answer. Because carbon 14 cannot date fossils, and it's never been used to date fossils. So why is it everybody tells me that? See, once something fossilizes, petrified, you've all seen petrified wood. You can still tell it's wood. You can tell it used to be a tree, but it's rock. Fossils turn to rock. The cells in the item are replaced by minerals turning it to rock. Once it turns to rock, you can't date it using carbon. You can only date real carbon items, real wood, real bone, real coal, real blood, real tissue, but not rock. And no scientist in the world, including me as a secular humanist scientist, I never stretched carbon into the million years because it's impossible. Carbon dissipates. Once the living organism dies, it starts to decay. The carbon dissipates. Up to about 5,000 to 7,000 years, it's pretty accurate. Past that, it gets really, drops into the abyss. And past 40,000 years, it's worthless. It's worthless anyway, past 7,000. But no scientist stretches it into the millions. So then you see what you're not being told? How do you get these dates of 3.7 million for Australopithecus afarensis or Australopithecus ramidus or 65 million for Jurassic? Nobody stops to ask. The teachers don't know. They say, oh, well, you know, you ignorant Christians, Genesis can't be true because we've carbon dated it at 6.3 million. Guys, that is nonsense. And the scientists know it. We use radioisotopes to get million-year dates, like uranium. Uranium-238 is a radioactive element that decays into a daughter product called lead. Rubidium, radioactive, decays into strontium, potassium, and argon. All these radioactive elements have a half-life, and we can measure the rate of decay at today's rate. That's the problem. You know that the half-life of uranium-238 is 4.5 billion years? How do you empirically prove that? You know what the half-life of carbon is? About 5,000 years, 4,000. You see, that's what we're not being told. Those radioisotope methods, by the way, can only be used to date igneous rock. Where are fossils found? Sedimentary rock only. So there is no method on this planet to date a fossil. Zero. We can date the closest igneous rock and then measure down and find the fossil or whatever, and we can speculate, theorize, but it is not empirical. Oh, so what is empirical? Well, let's take a look. Here is a definition from the National Academy of Science. Apparently, they're changing this because they realize how ignorant this is. It says, science is a particular way of knowing about the world. In science, explanations are limited to those based on observations and experiments that can be substantiated by other scientists. Now, here's the key. I want you to focus on this because the rest of this presentation focuses on that word, empirical. Explanations that cannot be based on empirical evidence are not a part of science. Does everybody follow that? Now, I wanted to make sure, so I looked up the word empirical to make sure that we're on the same page. Merriam-Webster Dictionary, empirical, relying on or based on observation and experience. Look at this, but capable of being verified or disproved by observation or experiment. That's empirical. So now, that same group of scientists down there in California that I ask how we date fossils, I thought I'd be clear, I ask them this question. And if anybody wants to try, give me an answer. How do you empirically prove Darwinian evolution? How do you empirically prove spontaneous generation? How do you empirically prove the Big Bang? You can't. So according to their definition, then it shouldn't be taught in the classroom. They did that to keep creation out of the classroom because they call creationism metaphysics, metaphysical. That's not real. That's not empirical. Well, neither is Darwinian evolution, folks. That's what I'm telling you. We're talking about two faith-based religions. And that's okay. That's just legitimate. But let's stop this fighting and throwing one out and keep. No, let's just teach it all. Let's teach creation and evolution. Let the evidence speak for itself. Let the math speak for it. But see, since Darwinian evolution cannot stand up to comparison, we outlaw the teaching. So if it's not empirical, then what is it? See, as a secular humanist, anti-Christian, I believed in a miracle. I believed in that first miracle. Only that one, no others though. And that first miracle was that life spontaneously generated from this warm little pond of chemicals. Because that is the only explanation. Empirically, it is nonsense. Mathematically, it is nonsense. Scientifically, it is nonsense. So the only other explanation, it was a miracle. Well, here's my definition of a miracle. A miracle is defined as an event that happens outside any known natural law. Does that sound good? For example, healing a leper, changing water into wine, and restoring life to the dead body certainly qualify as miracles. In a like manner, the spontaneous formation of life from a soup of chemicals also qualifies for a miracle status because this event too lies outside any known natural law. Do you follow what I'm saying? You see what I mean? Just use common sense and logic will tell you we're talking about two faith-based religions. Because I had great faith in science, in my religion. Didn't have a lot of evidence. But I didn't just make that two religions up. In his book, The Evolution Creation Struggle, Dr. Michael Ruse interprets the last 200 years of conflict between biology and religion as a struggle between evolutionism and creationism. He says, evolutionism is not merely an endorsement of the scientific theory of evolution. It consists of the whole metaphysical or ideological picture built on or around evolution. As such, it constitutes a secular religion. Thus, for Ruse, a philosopher of science at Florida State University, the debate over creationism and evolutionism is more a conflict between two religions than one between religion and science. Do you see what I'm saying? You see how that makes sense? And that's okay. But let's not beat each other up or beat Christian students up and tell them how ignorant and how crazy this is. And especially once we get to the math. Darwin had an agenda, folks. He set out to take God out of the picture. He was angry at God. But this used to be my life verse. I used to have this on my mirror and stuff, and I thought, how cool, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Wouldn't this be nice if we could just do this, attack the false idea, not the man who holds the idea? I thought that would be pretty cool, and then it dawned on me that my ideas are pretty firmly attached to me. So if you attack my idea, I feel like I'm being attacked. So how do we stop that? We stop attacking. We pray for each other. We allow each other to have different opinions. But let's get into what I told you, that four-letter word that strikes fear in the hearts of students everywhere, math. Look at this, right on the cover of Astronomy Magazine, how math drives the universe. Like I said, math just is. And that just infuriates scientists because it just is. But what is math? Math is information. Do you see what I said earlier? Information does not originate by itself in matter. So where does it come from? Has to have an intelligent design. Well, let's look at math. Let's go back to 1962 when I was in high school. Dr. Emil Borel. See, I was told that there was no absolutes, but impossibility comes when you get out to about a number as big as 10 to the 50th power. See, the occurrence of the event where the chances are beyond 1 in 10 followed by 50 zeros is an event we can state with certainty will never happen. No matter how much time is allotted, you see what I mean? Time does not give you any magic cure. No matter how much time is allotted or how many conceivable opportunities could exist for the event to take place, 10 to the 50th power. Guys, everybody in this room could write that number. It's a number with 50 zeros. But that is huge. If you don't think so, apply it to your checkbook and see how it looks. But 10 to the 50th power, do you realize that was the odds in 1962 of just one random act of spontaneous generation leading to life? And you realize there would have had to been multiple acts to create the diversity of the life forms we have on this planet? So if 10 to the 50 was just one, what do you think that number was? Well, let's jump ahead. Let's go 20 years. What do you think happened in the next 20 years? From when I was in high school, I actually had to go to the library. Now you can do more research in 5 minutes than I could do in a month. But in the next 20 years, the computer revolution occurred, and all of a sudden, we're doing math calculations that were mind-boggling. So what happened in the 20 years to that number with 50 zeros? Did it advance? You bet. But did it go from 50 zeros to 100 zeros to 500 zeros, 1,000? What do you think? How about this? The likelihood of the formation of life from inanimate matter is 1 to a number with 40,000 zeros after it. Try writing that number. It is big enough to bury Darwin in the whole theory of evolution. There was no primeval soup, neither on this planet nor any other, and if the beginnings of life were not random, they must have therefore been the product of purposeful intelligence. That's from Dr. Fred Hoyle, and that's out of Nature magazine. Not some Christian publication. But the students aren't told this. The teachers aren't told this. They don't even know it. That's the odds from the 60s to 10 to the 50th, 40,000 zeros for one random act. What do you think the laws of probability are on that one? Does it take a rocket scientist to figure out, you know, if you were told you had a brain tumor, but if you went over to hospital A, you got a 60% chance of total recovery. Pretty exciting. But if you go to hospital B, you got a 99.9% chance. Which one are you going to go to? You see what I mean about using common sense? So why is it when it comes to evolution and creation, we cop out for evolution in spite of these numbers? Well, that was just in 20 years. That was to the 80s. What do you think happened in 2018? Check this number out. We come to something called the anthropic principle. The anthropic principle is the fact that life could even exist on this planet. Look at this number. The anthropic principle, simply stated, is the fine-tuning of the physical universe to allow life to exist on this planet. In order to reach this mind-boggling degree of fine-tuning with so many different parameters smacks of some form of intelligent design. Are you catching the drift yet? This is coming from the secular world, folks. According to Penrose, and by the way, that's Dr. Roger Penrose. Look him up. You want to see a mathematician. Dr. Roger Penrose, he said it had to have been accurate. Now try this number on for size. It's 10 to 10, not 10 to the 100, but 10 to 10 to the 123rd power. That is a number so vast that it couldn't be written on a piece of paper the size of the entire visible universe. Now, do you see the kind of faith I had? You see what I mean when I said I had absolute faith? Because it took a lot of faith to believe in spontaneous generation of life in spite of these numbers. See, if it were 50, 60, 40, 30, something, yeah, but it's not. The odds of spontaneous generation are absolutely zero. But if all you have are two choices and you don't want to believe in God, what are you left with? You're left with Darwinian evolution in spite of the evidence. 10 to 10 to the 123rd power. You know, that number, to do that calculation, took the entire computer network of Cornell University. When you do that calculation, you know what it finally comes out to? It comes out to a big sideways 8. You know what that is? That's infinity. But we still hang on. I still believed because I did not want to believe in God. But the students and the teachers don't know this, folks. That's the sad part. Well, you ignorant Christians, you believe, you know, just look at the earth. It's obvious it's old. What's obvious about it? You know, when God created the flood, the Noahic flood, what was the first thing that happened after God shut the door? God brought the animals, but the fountains of the deep, then the windows of heaven, massive amounts of water. And it wasn't until after the flood that the mountains rose and the valleys sunk to allow the place for the water to go. Mount Everest wasn't there prior to the flood. But guess what happened when those fountains of the deep opened up, folks? We're talking about massive tectonic upheaval like never before. So when I look at the earth, I don't see obvious age. I see a planet that is recovering from a massive tectonic upheaval. See, at Mount St. Helens, I saw a canyon carved, and I'm going to show you that eruption in a few minutes. I saw a canyon carved 150 feet deep, a quarter mile across, and 15 miles long through solid bedrock in a matter of hours. If the world hadn't seen that, if I hadn't been there and witnessed it, I would have said it took millions of years for the water to have carved that canyon. Because when you look at it, it's obviously old. No, it's a matter of days. I saw coalification and fossilization occurring rapidly. And I asked some students, I asked the elementary kids, I said, how long do you think it takes to fossilize wood? And they're pretty funny because they say, oh, it takes 10,000 years. But I asked the college age and they give me, well, several billion years. Guys, you can fossilize wood in 1 hour in the laboratory. You know what it takes to fossilize something? It takes the right conditions. Heat, water, mineral, pressure. Guess what you get at a volcano? See, it doesn't necessarily take time. It takes the right conditions. That's why Mount St. Helens was so important. And that's the final blow. That's how hardened my heart was. It took a volcano to blow up and blow through that hard heart, folks. But 10 to 10 to the 123rd power, that is absolutely mind-numbing. In 1976, the National Academy of Science adopted this resolution. Try finding a copy of it. I had to go back to the archives. It's buried. They adopted this resolution in 76 because what was occurring? The computer revolution. We as scientists in that day were so sure that we were going to find the breakthrough that would finally drive the nail in the coffin to shut those ignorant Christians up that we adopted this resolution to protect the scientific community from the Christians. Well, now try finding it. I think it's a great resolution. Scientists should be allowed to follow the evidence of their research wherever it may lead without fear of retaliation. Whoa. Let me tell you, if you are a Christian and creation scientist, you are going to find retaliation. I have many friends who have lost their positions, lost their fellowship, lost their jobs as teachers because they are Christians. I have a friend who is involved in a major lawsuit because his son was denied entry into the doctoral program because he's a Christian. Why do you think that is? See, early on, I used to dismiss my Christian students. Oh, they would say, well, have you seen Dr. So-and-so? I said, oh, he's not a real scientist. He's a doctor of theology from some seminary. They aren't real scientists. Well, what about my mentor, Dr. A.E. Wilder Smith? He had 3 earned PhDs. Creation, sweet, gentle, humble man. Dr. Kurt Weiss, who was the leader of the science expedition that I'm still involved with, the Hansen Research Project, got his PhD at Harvard from Stephen Gould. I can go on and on and on. But I got to tell you something. The man who took me into Mount St. Helens crater in 1992, just a couple of years after I accepted Christ, Dr. Steve Austin, who is one of the world's renowned geologists and experts on coal in Mount St. Helens, you know, he had to use an assumed name to get his doctorate because he was a Christian, a creationist. And he told me, he says, you know, every single friend of his, every colleague that he knows who succumbed to the old age, the theistic evolution, he says, not one single one of them is still walking with the Lord. Now, that doesn't mean they lost their salvation. It just means they're miserable. And they got sucked into that lie. That's why it's important that we stick to God's word. God said what he meant what he said, and it is all true. And as I said, Darwin had an agenda. Here's the title of his book, Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection and the Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. Guess where racism came from, folks? God didn't create races. He said of one blood. But Darwin had an agenda. He set out to take God out of the picture because his daughter died, and he said, how can a loving God allow this? A loving God didn't. It was called sin. It was called the fall, the curse. But look what he says. The Old Testament, from its manifestly false history of the earth, was no more to be trusted than the sacred books of the Hindus or the beliefs of any barbarian. The New Testament is a damnable doctrine. I can hardly see how anyone ought to wish Christianity to be true. That was his mindset, folks. He was not a scientist, by the way. He was a naturalist, and he wasn't even a good naturalist. But you see the impact he has had, how Satan is the master deceiver, and how he can use that to just get you twisted. See, Acts 17:26, and God hath made of one blood all nations of men for to dwell on the face of the earth. God did not create races or racism. Man did. Sin did. How about this? New Scientist, Darwin was wrong, right on the cover of their own magazine. See, the scientific community knows this. Unfortunately, it's not being passed on to the teachers and the students. Now, here's a chart. Remember I told you about carbon dating and radioisotope dating? This is out of the UC Davis textbook. Look what it says. So look, it says uranium-238. Look at the half-life, 4.5 billion years, like I told you. But look what it can date. It can date zircon and uraniumite. How many of you know what that is? And how does that compute in dating fossils? You can't. You can only date igneous rock. But see, look at carbon. Carbon 14, 5,700 years half-life. Look what it can date. Coal, wood, you see what I mean? This is in the textbook, but the students don't know it. This used to be kind of subtle how the scientific community would mess with the creationists. And says, this is out of a book, Scientific American. And this man, this journalist, is talking about the inflationary model, which Alan Garth, that was the Big Bang. Did you realize that very few scientists really still adhere to the Big Bang? Do you know that it's broken? But he's talking about the inflation from the Big Bang. But look what he says. The idea of inflation is so compelling that cosmologists, including me, routinely describe it to students, journalists, and the public. That's you guys, students, journalists, and the public, as an established fact. Guys, do you catch what that's saying? Even though they know it's not an established fact, they teach it as if it were. Guys, where I come from, that's a lie. It says, something peculiar has happened to the inflationary theory over the 30 years since Alan Guth introduced it. The case for inflation has grown stronger, so is the case against it. But the students and the teachers don't know this. Guys, I get so tired. I kind of feel like this. It's just mind-numbing. This is something called the knowledge filter. This is where those bags I was talking about, they're canvas bags and they have a red or a yellow seal. And I can show you warehouses full of these things. The lead seal is so you can't tamper with it and open it. Hundreds of thousands of fossils. But listen to what this guy's talking about called the knowledge filter.
Basically what you find is something we call a knowledge filter. This is a fundamental feature of science. It's also a fundamental feature of human nature. People tend to filter out things that don't fit, that don't make sense in terms of their paradigm or their way of thinking. So in science, you find that evidence that doesn't fit the accepted paradigm tends to be eliminated. It's not taught, it's not discussed, and people who are educated in scientific teachings generally don't even learn about
it. You see what he's saying? People who are teachers, scientists, don't even know. It's a knowledge filter because it doesn't fit the prescribed worldview. That's just wrong. That's why I'm out here. This is what I wanted to do, is give you the other side of the story. Now, as I said, carbon cannot date rock. But carbon is a good dating procedure for a limited area, for real blood, real tissue, things like that. So when this magazine came out, look what it says. Brave New World. Soft tissue and blood cells found in T-Rex shock paleontology. Guys, it turned paleontology on its ear. It just devastated the scientific community. Dr. Mary Schweitzer and Dr. Jennifer Whitmire found this fossil that was pretty complete, and they took it back to the lab, this T-Rex, and they found soft tissue, elastic tissue, skin, blood cells, hemoglobin. Guys, you can date that with carbon. But it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure that one out either. How long do you think red blood cells and skin and tissue would last if it's even frozen? It won't last for millions of years. 65 million years? Do you think that's possible? Do you see what I mean about the odds? Well, watch this. This kind of explains it. Once this came out, scientists from around the world came out.
In 1990, a nearly complete specimen of Tyrannosaurus rex was unearthed. Scientists from Montana State University found that these bones were not totally fossilized. Sections of the bone were like fresh bone and contained what seems to be blood cells and hemoglobin, which is a protein that makes blood red and carries oxygen. Now, they're still investigating these controversial discoveries, but common sense would say that if these bones really were tens of millions of years old, then the blood cells and the hemoglobin would have totally disintegrated by now. And the bones certainly shouldn't be fresh.
More recently, in 2002, scientists split open a T-Rex thigh bone and discovered flexible, even elastic, soft tissue meat still inside. Microscopic examination revealed fine, delicate blood vessels with what appear to be intact red blood cells and other type of cells, like osteocytes, which are bone-forming cells. These vessels were soft, translucent, and flexible.
The mummified carcass of a duck-billed hadrosaur named Leonardo also turned up in Montana. The preserved soft tissue, covering 90% of the fossil, contained muscle, nail material, a beak, and skin.
His last meal consisted of a salad of ferns, conifers, and magnolias, seasoned with pollen from 40 different plants.
This type of evidence would undoubtedly lead one to realize that dinosaurs probably aren't as old as previously thought. But for those of the evolutionary mindset, they're busy scrambling, trying to prove how dinosaurs and soft tissue survived for over 65 million years. Because, of course, dinosaurs died out way before man came along. Right?
You see what I mean about what's not being told? It's just sad. It's disgusting. Now, when they found the red blood cells in the skin and stuff, that could be tested. But let me tell you, I went into Mount St. Helens in 1992 to take a sample of the igneous rock, the lava dome that oozed up in there, slowly cooled and crystallized into an igneous rock called dacite. It took 12 years. So now we know how old the rock is. So now we can send it to the lab and we can see how accurate the dating is. But doing carbon dating is excruciatingly expensive. Doing any type of dating is excruciatingly expensive. The research we did at Mount St. Helens was financed by Christians from around the world. It took 3 years and many, many thousands of dollars to do. Wait till you see what we found. But when these people were asked, well, you've got soft tissue and skin, have you carbon dated it? They said, well, no, it's really expensive and we don't need to because we already know it's 65 million years. You see how that works? That is nonsense. Here's the picture I was on. This is on the cover of Scientific American. Look what it says. The Big Bang Theory. Why our best explanation of how the universe evolved must be fixed or replaced. Do you see the problem with that? Why would you fix it or replace it if it wasn't broken? But see, most of the scientists in the world realize that there are major problems with the Big Bang. But the students and the teachers don't know it. The 6 o'clock news doesn't know it. See, look at this. After the Big Bang, we're told life spontaneously arose from ordinary chemicals. But even the most ardent evolutionists will admit that they cannot explain how this happened. Ask whether he had any idea how life started. Richard Dawkins replied, no, nor has anybody. Do you catch what they just said? That's their own people. So how does that fit with that definition of empirical?
Well, you know, evolution's been proven, empirically proven. You know, just look at it.
Well, the scientists don't know it even. How about this one? A large percentage of scientists and astronomers and astrophysicists believe that our solar system evolved into existence over a very long time when dust particles started to clump together into bigger and bigger clumps until they eventually became planetesimals. Once these planetesimals have formed, further growth into planets may occur, though through gravitational accretion. Just how this takes place is what? Still not understood. That's from Astrophysical Concepts, their journal. How about this one? How the first stage of this process of primary accretion, just like they said, works is a fundamental unsolved problem of planetary science. But the students and the teachers don't know this. You see what I mean about how Christians are being beaten up and just slammed with, well, you can't believe it if you're one of those ignorant Christians. Guys, that is just wrong. As I said, look at this. Petrified wood. We can petrify wood in an hour. Well, I'm going to cut to the chase right here. I'm going to show you the eruption of Mount St. Helens. Mount St. Helens was considered one of the most beautiful places on Earth. It erupted May 18th, 1980, 17 seconds past 8:32 in the morning. See, I'll never forget that. 57 people died that morning, folks. One of them was David Johnson. David Johnson was a young geologist. He was not, he wasn't even supposed to be there. He was on a ridge. We had set up the, see, volcanoes don't sneak up on us, so we knew something was going to happen. Scientists from around the world was there. We had a, in Vancouver, we had a National Geologic Survey set up their headquarters. We had equipment set up and we were measuring, you know, the volcano and the tremors. And you're going to hear the last words of David Johnson. He was on a radio when this thing blasted and he's screaming, "Vancouver, Vancouver, this is it." Those were the last words. But those 57 people, most of them should not have even been there. But you can see that's considered a beautiful, it's a perfect cinder cone volcano, but it's a stratovolcano. Hawaiian volcanoes are called shield volcanoes. They're really beautiful, very fluid magma flows. Stratovolcanoes are extremely dangerous and explosive. That's how it looked on the morning of May 18th. Here's how it looked a couple of weeks later. Total devastation. But see, Mount St. Helens didn't do what we thought it would do. See how it's kind of got that little horseshoe shape? What we didn't realize is that prior to the eruption, the north face of the volcano was bulging at over 50 feet per day. In fact, just before it blew, it looked like a pregnant volcano. What was happening is magma was forcing its way up through a lava chamber, and it weakened the mountain. So on the morning of May 18th, there was a 5.1 earthquake right at the base, and the entire mountain slid. Guys, it was the largest landslide in recorded history. A half a cubic mile of debris slid. Now, David Johnson was on a ridge 5 miles away and 1,400 feet high in elevation. Had it done what we thought it would do, blow up, like, you know, straight up like that, he would have been fine. But the fact that that landslide left, the landslide traveled at over 150 miles an hour, completely across that 5 miles and up over that ridge. Destroyed everything. It leveled enough trees in that initial six-minute blast to build 650,000 three-bedroom homes. We witnessed the canyon carved, like I told you, call it the little Grand Canyon. Well, fossilization, coalification occurring. You can see almost 4,000 feet of the elevation lift. But once that landslide occurred, the blast was directed straight north, right at David Johnson. He saw it coming, 300 miles an hour. Here is the drainage system of that. That's just the beginning of that little Grand Canyon that was carved in a matter of hours, folks. Had we not seen that happen, we would have said it took hundreds of thousands, millions of years for that to occur. See that there, that's the visitor center. That's where David Johnson was. It's called Johnson Ridge Visitor Center. That's Spirit Lake over there. Now, here are some of the strata that was laid down. You can see the grad student down there pointing at it. See, that first little area right here, you can see the strata. That was laid down in the 600-mile-an-hour blast. Minute strata. That top layer, that black section, is an old mud flow. But you can see the pyroclastic degree, the mud flow, the ash fall, all of these different layers that happened immediately, rapidly. Here we have the grad student. Look, she's pointing out, look at, if we didn't know how we got there, I would tell you that took millions of years. You know, here was a wet year and a dry year, and this layer was laid down, and then, you see what I mean? But we know it happened rapidly. Geologic catastrophism. Well, here you're going to see what David Johnson saw, and we'll finish right here. You're going to hear his last words. And you're going to see what he saw coming at him.
Vancouver, Vancouver, this is it!
Thank you.
never found his body or any portion of the equipment. There were people flying over that ridge, then they almost got blown out of the sky. But see that lava dome right there in the center? That's what we went in, or we watched that form. It's acting like a giant cork right now. Well, in 1992, I was invited to go back in there by Dr. Steve Austin. I should have been suspicious. See, that was only a couple years after I accepted Christ. And he knew that I had been at Mount St. Helens when the eruption occurred, and you know, that I had now become a Christian, and so he wanted to see if I'd go on this expedition with him. I should have been suspicious, because when this great geologist invites me, a lowly biologist, to go on this great expedition, what I found out later is he couldn't get permission to take a mule, so he took a biologist. I carried the backpack. I even carried his lunch. Look at that. He kept sticking rocks in the backpack, 60 pounds of rock in there. But we went in there. See that canyon? See that waterfall back there? That wasn't there the week before. We had to stop there, not because it was a beautiful place to have lunch, it's because we had to reroute our, when we'd flown over the week before, that canyon wasn't there. That's how quickly these events from the mud flows could occur. Now, see that lava dome? That's igneous rock. It slowly cooled and crystallized into an igneous rock called dacite. So we went in and took a chunk of the rock, prepared it. Like I said, and it took a long, hard time. This is a piece of it. I usually carry it with me, but somehow it didn't get on this trip. But it was paid for by Christians from around the world. It took 3 years to complete the research. We sent it to 9 different labs. We didn't tell them where we found it. We just told them, give us a date. Well, we know it's 12 years old, so, you know, you got a fudge factor, you know, but not a few million. We got dates all the way up to 2.7 million years for 12-year-old rock. Now, that doesn't prove anything other than the fact that the equipment is suspect, that the dating procedures are junk. But guys, that's all we have, so we stick with it. That's the best we have. What else do we do? So that's why I say we've got to stop this arguing and bad-mouthing the creationists. Let's teach it all and let you use the brains God has given you to figure it out. Now, I found this Pachycephalosaurus skull, and that's for a whole new lecture. We'll do it. But right alongside that, I found a piece of wood that was petrified. So I had my grad students dig it out with toothbrushes and dental tools. That's what grad students are for. But that piece of wood was petrified. Well, once we got into the bank and got it out, part of it was coalified. The last 28 inches of it was pure wood. Now, how many million years do you think that can happen? Wood rots if it doesn't petrify. So you see, there's all of these things. I could go on and on. And by the way, here's what a Pachycephalosaurus looks like. My mom said it was a good find. Pachy means thick and cephala head. But we're going to stop. I didn't get into the astronomy, just a little bit telling you about how the Big Bang is. I have a 2 one-hour sessions on astronomy. You won't believe what that's showing. How many have seen the pictures of from Hubble? Aren't those absolutely mind-boggling? Do you realize we've seen a few thousand? You know how many have been sent back? Millions. But they were not available for we ignorant Christians. They need further interpretation. You see what I mean? But even this, the astronomy is showing that even the universe doesn't fit with a 4.5 billion years. It is a young universe. Everything God says is true. There's not one word of science that contradicts God's word. Genesis to Revelation, 100% true. Every jot and every tittle.